This is MSO News Sports. I'm Bill Newell, and we are joined by Jeff Diehl, Republican candidate for governor, and the primary coming up right after Labor Day. Jeff, welcome. Good to be talking with you.
Hey, Bill. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, we have a Republican governor now, Charlie Baker from Swampscott here on the North Shore. If you become governor in November, how will the Diehl administration be similar or maybe slightly different than Charlie Baker's?
Well, I think with the Baker administration, we've had great success bringing a lot of, additional biotech industries to Massachusetts. We've seen, I think growth in the state revenue-wise. We have excess tax revenue more than ever before, over $3 billion, which is thankfully going to be returned back to the people thanks to a statute in the law from 1986. But, for me, I come from a small business world. I didn't get involved in politics until I was 40 years old. I ran for state representative. I served in the legislature. I was on the Ways and Means Committee, and for 4 years, I learned all about how the state spends its money, where it goes, how the agencies work. So for me, I'm bringing, I think, a small business perspective up to Beacon Hill where, employees are important. And I think that's important now more than ever because we're seeing a lot of state workers have either left their jobs because of the vaccine mandate. I want to give them their jobs back. But we're also, not necessarily supporting those who are currently working in state agencies the way I think they need to be supported. Like the MBTA. I think they're very frustrated with a lot of problems going on. And my role is to, I think, make sure that the current workers feel empowered to stand up and make better suggestions about how to do things rather than just keep quiet and let things go the way they always go, right? I don't want to bring consultants in. I don't want to, have political appointees come in and tell them just keep doing things the way it was always done. Let's talk to the employees directly and get them to be more empowered in how they deliver, whether it's a DCF or at MBTA or at state troopers. I just want to make sure I'm a governor that will listen to everybody. And, it may not be that much different than what Governor Baker's done, but I want to continue that effort. And I think that's why Massachusetts has brought in Republican governors 24 of the last 32 years. We tend to be good managers of people.
I look at moments, and we seem like we're in a moment where things are just going wrong for the MBTA with the green line, with the orange line. It reminds me of the Mitt Romney moment when the ceiling fell in the Ted Williams tunnel and all those videos and photographs and so on. And, the horror, if you will. But what about the MBTA? Is this just something that's just the timing, everything's going bad? Or what happened here with the MBTA?
Yeah, our eyes were fully open after 2015 when that blizzard basically shut it down for 2 months. And we started to learn about maybe some of the dysfunction with deferred maintenance and all that. And I think Governor Baker has been trying to work on that. But really, we continue to have major problems. And it's not just equipment. It's also, I think, management type issues. We're understaffed right now. The federal government stepped in to try to, see where they can help try to make some changes here and for safety reasons. And I think one of the things is we've had bad decisions in the past. I don't think bringing in, a Chinese firm to build our rail cars was the smartest decision under the Patrick administration, for example. Those cars have been coming in late and not necessarily meeting the requirements needed. And so we've had issues just based on that. But it's also not necessarily a financial issue. Back in 2014, I led the repeal to stop the indexing of our state's gas tax to inflation. We knew a lot of money that from the gas tax was being diverted to the T, and yet no matter how much money was poured into the problem, it wasn't fixing things. Similar to what's going on in Boston Public Schools right now, you've got very low graduation rates. Boston Public Schools are on the verge of we're on the verge of receivership as well. And they're still the highest spending per student is at Boston Public Schools. So sometimes pouring money into a problem doesn't fix it. In fact, it sort of glosses over the underlying issues. I think with the T, again, it's about personnel being empowered to do their jobs because they know how things should work. And also making, I think, better capital decisions on where our equipment comes from and how we deploy things. I certainly want to see expanded public transportation services, whether it's South Coast Rail or East West Rail or other ways to strengthen overall our public transportation. I used to live in New York City. I met my wife there on a blind date. Neither of us had a car for the first 5 years we were married because we were able to get around on public rail. I'm a big fan of public transportation. I just want to make sure it works here in Massachusetts.
Yeah. Well, it seems like it's not working for some people right now, as we're finding out. I want to just shift. Let's go to the economy issue. An issue like that, very complex, all kinds of aspects to it: housing, inflation, food, fuel, all these major problems that are facing Massachusetts residents and actually all residents around the country. What about our Massachusetts economy?
Well, you know, a barometer I use is, you know, how many people are coming into or leaving the state. And right now we had a record amount of people leaving Massachusetts last year. 50,000 people left our state. Some of it, I think, is, you know, the affordability issue. Obviously, we've got inflation now hitting our food costs. Fuel is out of control, of course, and the legislature did nothing to try to alleviate the situation. They had all this additional tax revenue, did not do anything to try to, you know, give us a break on our gas tax temporarily. But at the same time, housing costs have really gone through the roof. And so folks who want to either downsize or people who are first-time buyers, they're looking at Massachusetts and saying, you know, where can I go, even if I sold my home or if I'm trying to get into my first house, where can I go to find something affordable? You know, if you live in South Boston, Southie, the triple-deckers, a floor on the triple-decker down there goes for $1 million. So I think, again, part of what we need to do is find ways to do more development outside of our cities where there's high demand. And we also have a lot of infrastructure already built in Springfield out in Western Mass or in Worcester. You know, try to take advantage of areas. Now that we know that people don't necessarily have to go to their physical corporate offices every day with remote work, maybe there's a way to find more affordable housing solutions there too. So, you know, the economy is going to be something that I think does continue to drive the debate, especially up until November, because it feels like right now we're in the early stages of a recession, and federal, you know, monetary policy continuing to print money is just going to continue to deflate the value of what we've got in our bank books right now. I know a lot of people are seeing their 401ks down 10, 15, 20%. That really causes a concern for people, and it creates that consumer lack of confidence that then affects, you know, spending, which affects companies and their hiring plans. So really, we need to get ahead of this as quickly as possible so that we don't see a breakdown and a potentially worse economic situation on the horizon.
I want to talk about education. It looks like school kids in Massachusetts are heading back in September, late August, I guess. School starts early for some. But it'll probably be their first kind of normal year almost in a couple of years, and an uninterrupted year possibly. But I guess, what's your take on education? You know, what needs to be done? And where are we after at least 2 years here of COVID?
Yeah, so, you know, I had two daughters in school, at the public school at the time when COVID hit. One of them's graduated and now is in college. And during that time, 2020, the final couple months of the year, everything just deteriorated. The public schools were not ready to handle remote learning. You know, every school district seemed to have different platforms for education. Every platform had different programs, and every teacher had different skill levels. So kids were, you know, going online and you just had no idea what consistency there was going to be as far as were they getting the content. I think everybody pretty much admits now we're at least 1 or 2 years behind on educating our kids in Massachusetts, and that's a problem because we don't just have to stay competitive, you know, in our state and regionally. We have to stay competitive globally to make sure that our kids have that the tools they need to get out into either the workforce or off to college prepared for what's next. But, you know, one of the things that frustrated me, the Mass Teachers Association really was very reluctant to get back into the schools. The kids then also were forced to wear masks in schools, you know, late into last year when we knew after a while that they were the least vulnerable population with COVID. You know, so it was very difficult, especially young kids, to see them with masks on and have their learning interrupted, you know, at a time when they're trying to learn languages and really feed off of, you know, interaction with other people facially. So I think a lot of parents were frustrated. We're seeing an increase in homeschooling in Massachusetts by 11%, and that's a significant number. Even private schools are seeing double-digit spikes in enrollment right now because I think people were frustrated with, you know, the public schools and their ability to deliver a quality education. But on top of that, I think parents are also concerned a little bit about the curriculum issue that's going on. There's, you know, an effort to try to push sexual preference education at a very young age, kindergarten, first, second, third grade. I think that's really best left to parents to deal with and not for teachers to try to explain. And then again, there's sort of an effort, I believe, diversity, equity, inclusion, or CRT, sort of an effort to continue to tell our kids that they are inherently racist. Even then, you know, again, my wife and I have tried to make sure our kids have no racist tendencies, and yet the schools are telling them they are racist and there's nothing they can do about it. I don't think parents are really happy about that effort to sort of indoctrinate kids on a certain philosophy. Most parents, I think, want kids to be learning the key things, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic, as we used to say back in the day. But, you know, financial literacy, making sure that when they leave high school, they either go into a vocational school or job that they want right away, or they go off to a four-year college that matches sort of a career goal that they have. And those are really the overriding things that people want from their schools. So I think education is something that really is going to be important going forward as well.
You know, mental health for students was an issue before COVID. To be quite honest with you, it was an increasing kind of issue for students. But now, I don't think we have any idea where we're at with the mental health issues. Maybe we'll find out in another month or so, or get a better indicator from the schools where that is. But that's got to be a huge issue.
Yeah, I think the pandemic really caused a major problem with mental health, right? A lot of people were sent home. They weren't essential employees. That's got to weigh on you. If you're home getting unemployment and you feel like you're not able to contribute, you know, in a way you've been doing for years in the workforce, kids in schools, again, feeling like they're getting behind in education, you know, that affects them with mental health issues. And I think what we saw was a spike in use of opioids. We had the largest overdose deaths in the state of Massachusetts last year. We were trying to get a hold of the opioid and drug use in Massachusetts, and we kind of went the other way. The pandemic really hit that. So it's not just drug use, though. It's just overall mental health. We need to make sure that there's more available options for people. And a lot of times those services are made, you know, available to the public in centralized areas, big cities, whether it's opioid recovery or whether it's mental health care. I remember when I was in the legislature, there was an attempt to centralize mental health care to Worcester, and yeah, they were trying to close Taunton State Hospital, for example, down in the south coast region. Anyway, a lot of people were frustrated that, you know, they weren't going to be able to see their loved ones on a regular basis because they would have to travel so far to get the mental health care or be away from family for that mental health care. What I want to do is push those services more into the suburban areas. We need to make sure that the suburbs know they own some of the addiction issues and the mental health care that's required for their folks. And we should not have a not-in-my-backyard attitude when it comes to providing more of those state services. So that's one thing I want to centrifuge back out into areas beyond big cities.
I want to take on one more issue here, law enforcement. So you have law enforcement, which is a complex issue because it's local, it's state, it's federal. Borders are involved, all different prosecutors, all these and different levels of prosecutors, county prosecutors, and so on. So I guess tell me about law enforcement. What's your position on law enforcement?
Yeah, so Bill, the thing I've been talking to right at the top level, state police, they're very frustrated. The vaccine mandates, a lot of them were forced to either retire early or they didn't want to get the vaccine. They were fired, lost the ability to work in law enforcement anywhere else because of the way they were discharged. So one of the things on day one I'm going to do is not just with state police, but all state workers, anybody who is fired with a vaccine mandate, I'm going to hire them back on day one because I don't think government had the right to tell you your own health care choices. I think that it should be personal. Some of these folks got natural immunity from working on the front lines when there was no vaccine available, and they contracted COVID, developed that natural immunity. Some of them just have underlying health issues that really the vaccines could have exacerbated and caused problems with. So I always feel like government should never overstep that bounds on your health care. But then on top of that, there's also sort of this defund the police thing that we're still dealing with. We've got non-prosecute lists coming from certain politically elected DAs that don't believe in prosecution of certain crimes. And I think that's causing a lot of dismay with law enforcement that the work they're doing really is not having any effect. And so we're seeing a problem with recruitment, not just at the state police level, but at the local level. Police departments are dealing with understaffing. They are dealing with having to work their current officers for longer shifts. And I think what that's creating is a dangerousness issue overall. I mean, you have people working too long in any job, it's hard, but as police officers, where it's vital that they're out there and have to make split-second decisions, we don't need to have them overworked. So I want to make sure law enforcement is getting the support they need, not just with resources to do their job, but also just getting the feeling that the government elected officials are not against them, we're with them and want them to continue to keep our communities safe. So that's something that hopefully they get the message with my administration, and I'll be sure to work really hard to work on that for the first 4 to 8 years if I'm lucky enough to get a second term. But, you know, it's something that I think they're the glue to our society, and I want to make sure they know that I really appreciate them.
Yeah. We're talking with the Republican candidate for governor, Jeff Gill. Jeff, any final closing thoughts or anything I might not have asked you about you want to share with our listeners up here on the North Shore?
Well, you know, I did partner with Leah Allen, who was a former state representative. She's now my running mate for lieutenant governor. She's from Peabody originally, now living in Danvers with her husband and two kids. She's a nurse who actually was fired for not getting the vaccine. She was pregnant during the pandemic, was working on a COVID floor, actually, did not when the vaccines weren't available. When they became available, she was nursing her child and did not want to get the vaccine for fear of any effects on the child, and she was fired for that. So somebody who's living the same, you know, sort of nightmare scenario of the workforce, but she has experience on Beacon Hill as a state representative as well. She is really fired up to work with me to make sure that we listen to the people of Massachusetts, work for them, not special interest groups or the power brokers that tend to decide how things are going to go for us. And so Leah Allen, I'm really proud, again, to have a North Shore person who's on the ticket with me, and I think people are going to be very pleased to see the work that she and I are able to do once we're in office.
Right. Jeff Gill, thanks so much for your time, and hopefully we can talk again soon.
Appreciate it, Bill. Thank you so much.
Candidate for Governor Jeff Gill. I'm Bill Newell on MSONewsSports.com.